Chapter 3. How the Brigadier captured Zaragoza. Have I ever told you, my friends, the circumstances connected with my joining the Hussars of Conflans at the time of the siege of Zaragoza, and the very remarkable exploit which I performed in connection with the taking of that city? No? Then you have indeed something still to learn. I will tell it to you exactly as it occurred. Save for two or three men, and a score or two of women, you are the first who have ever heard the story. You must know, then, that it was in the 2nd Hussars, called the Hussars of Chambrun, that I had served as a lieutenant, and as a junior captain. At the time I speak of, I was only 25 years of age, as reckless and desperate a man as any in that great army. It chanced that the war had come to a halt in Germany, while it was still raging in Spain, so the Emperor, wishing to reinforce the Spanish army, transferred me as senior captain to the Hussars of Conflans, which were at that time in the 5th Army Corps under Marshal Lannes. It was a long journey from Berlin to the Pyrenees. My new regiment formed part of the force which, under Marshal Lannes, was then besieging the Spanish town of Zaragoza. I turned my horse's head in that direction, therefore, and behold me a week or so later at the French headquarters, whence I was directed to the camp of the Hussars of Conflans. You have read, no doubt, of this famous siege of Zaragoza, and I will only say that no general could have had a harder task than that with which Marshal Lannes was confronted. The immense city was crowded with a horde of Spaniards, soldiers, peasants, priests, all filled with the most furious hatred of the French, and the most savage determination to perish, before they would surrender. There were 80,000 men in the town, and only 30,000 to besiege them. Yet we had a powerful artillery, and our engineers were of the best. There was never such a siege, for it is usual, that when the fortifications are taken the city falls, but here it was not until the fortifications were taken, that the real fighting began. Every house was a fort and every street a battlefield, so that slowly, day by day, we had to work our way inwards, blowing up the houses with their garrisons until more than half the city had disappeared. Yet the other half was as determined as ever, and in a better position for defense, since it consisted of enormous convents and monasteries with walls like the Bastille, which could not be so easily brushed out of our way. This was the state of things at the time that I joined the army. I will confess to you that cavalry are not of much use in a siege, although there was a time when I would not have permitted anyone to have made such an observation. The Hussars of Conflans were encamped to the south of the town, and it was their duty to throw out patrols, and to make sure that no Spanish force was advancing from that quarter. The colonel of the regiment was not a good soldier, and the regiment was at that time very far from being in the high condition which it afterwards attained. Even in that one evening I saw several things which shocked me, for I had a high standard, and it went to my heart, to see an ill-arranged camp, an ill-groomed horse, or a slovenly trooper. That night I supped with 26 of my new brother officers, and I fear that in my zeal I showed them only too plainly that I found things very different to what I was accustomed in the army of Germany. There was silence in the mess after my remarks, and I felt that I had been indiscreet when I saw the glances that were cast at me. The colonel especially was furious, and a great major named Olivier, who was the fire-eater of the regiment, sat opposite to me curling his huge black mustaches, and staring at me, as if he would eat me. However, I did not resent his attitude, for I felt that I had indeed been indiscreet, and that it would give a bad impression if upon this my first evening I quarreled with my superior officer. So far I admit that I was wrong, but now I come to the sequel. Supper over, the colonel and some other officers left the room, for it was in a farmhouse that the mess was held. There remained a dozen or so, and a goatskin of Spanish wine having been brought in, we all made merry. Presently this Major Olivier asked me some questions concerning the army of Germany, and as to the part which I had myself played in the campaign. Flushed with the wine, I was drawn on from story to story. It was not unnatural, my friends. You will sympathize with me. Up there I had been the model for every officer of my years in the army. I was the first swordsman, the most dashing rider, the hero of 100 adventures. Here I found myself not only unknown, but even disliked. Was it not natural that I should wish to tell these brave comrades what sort of man it was that had come among them? Was it not natural that I should wish to say, "Rejoice, my friends, rejoice. It is no ordinary man who has joined you tonight, but it is I, the Gerard, the hero of Ratisbon, the victor of Jena, the man who broke the square at Austerlitz"? I could not say all this. But I could at least tell them some incidents which would enable them to say it for themselves. I did so. They listened unmoved. I told them more. At last, after my tale of how I had guided the army across the Danube, one universal shout of laughter broke from them all. I sprang to my feet, flushed with shame and anger. They had drawn me on. They were making game of me. They were convinced that they had to do with a braggart and a liar. Was this my reception in the hussars of Conflans? I dashed the tears of mortification from my eyes, and they laughed the more at the sight. "Do you know, Captain Peloton, whether Marshal Lannes is still with the army?" asked the major. "I believe that he is, sir," said the other. "Really, I should have thought that his presence was hardly necessary now that Captain Gerard has arrived." Again there was a roar of laughter. I can see the ring of faces, the mocking eyes, the open mouths, Olivier with his great black bristles, Peloton thin and sneering, even the young sub-lieutenants convulsed with merriment. Heavens, the indignity of it! But my rage had dried my tears. I was myself again, cold, quiet, self-contained, ice without and fire within. "May I ask, sir," said I to the major, "at what hour the regiment is paraded? I trust, Captain Gerard, that you do not mean to alter our hours," said he, and again there was a burst of laughter, which died away as I looked slowly round the circle. "What hour is the assembly?" I asked, sharply, of Captain Peloton. Some mocking answer was on his tongue, but my glance kept it there. "The assembly is at 6, he answered. "I thank you," said I. I then counted the company and found that I had to do with 14 officers, two of whom appeared to be boys fresh from St. Sir. I could not condescend to take any notice of their indiscretion. There remained the major, 4 captains, and 7 lieutenants. "Gentlemen," I continued, looking from one to the other of them, "I should feel myself unworthy of this famous regiment if I did not ask you for satisfaction for the rudeness with which you have greeted me, and I should hold you to be unworthy of it if on any pretext you refused to grant it." "You will have no difficulty upon that score," said the major. "I am prepared to waive my rank and to give you every satisfaction in the name of the Hussars of Conflans." "I thank you," I answered. "Feel, however, that I have some claim upon these other gentlemen who laughed at my expense." "Whom would you fight, then?" asked Captain Peloton. "All of you," I answered. They looked in surprise from one to the other. Then they drew off to the other end of the room, and I heard the buzz of their whispers. They were laughing. Evidently they still thought that they had to do with some empty braggart. Then they returned. "Your request is unusual," said Major Olivier, "but it will be granted. How do you propose to conduct such a duel?" "The terms lie with you." "Sabers," said I, "and I will take you in order of seniority, beginning with you, Major Olivier, at 5 o'clock. I will thus be able to devote 5 minutes to each before the assembly is blown. I must, however, beg you to have the courtesy to name the place of meeting, since I am still ignorant of the locality." They were impressed by my cold and practical manner. Already the smile had died away from their lips. Olivier's face was no longer mocking, but it was dark and stern. "There is a small open space behind the horse lines," said he. "We have held a few affairs of honor there, and it has done very well. We shall be there, Captain Gerard, at the hour you name." I was in the act of bowing to thank them for their acceptance, when the door of the mess room was flung open, and the colonel hurried into the room, with an agitated face. "Gentlemen," said he, "I have been asked to call for a volunteer from among you for a service which involves the greatest possible danger. I will not disguise from you that the matter is serious in the last degree, and that Marshal Lannes has chosen a cavalry officer because he can be better spared than an officer of infantry or of engineers. Married men are not eligible. Of the others, who will volunteer? I need not say that all the unmarried officers stepped to the front. The colonel looked round in some embarrassment. I could see his dilemma. It was the best man who should go, and yet it was the best man whom he could least spare. Sir, said I, may I be permitted to make a suggestion? He looked at me with a hard eye. He had not forgotten my observations at supper. Peak, said he. I would point out, sir, said I, that this mission is mine both by right and by convenience. Why so, Captain Gerard? By right because I am the senior captain. By convenience because I shall not be missed in the regiment since the men have not yet learned to know me. The colonel's features relaxed. There is certainly truth in what you say, Captain Gerard, said he. Think that you are indeed best fitted to go upon this mission. If you will come with me, I will give you your instructions. I wished my new comrades good night as I left the room, and I repeated that I should hold myself at their disposal at 5 o'clock next morning. They bowed in silence, and I thought that I could see from the expression of their faces that they had already begun to take a more just view of my character. I had expected that the colonel would at once inform me what it was that I had been chosen to do, but instead of that he walked on in silence, I following behind him. We passed through the camp, and made our way across the trenches, and over the ruined heaps of stones which marked the old wall of the town. Within, there was a labyrinth of passages formed among the debris of the houses which had been destroyed by the mines of the engineers. Acres and acres were covered with splintered walls and piles of brick which had once been a populous suburb. Lanes had been driven through it, and lanterns placed at the corners with inscriptions to direct the wayfarer. The colonel hurried onward until at last, after a long walk, we found our way barred by a high gray wall which stretched right across our path. Here behind a barricade, lay our advance guard. The colonel led me into a roofless house, and there I found two general officers, a map stretched over a drum in front of them, they kneeling beside it, and examining it carefully by the light of a lantern. The one with the clean-shaven face and the twisted neck was Marshal Lannes, the other was General Razout, the head of the engineers. Captain Gerard has volunteered to go, said the colonel. Marshal Lannes rose from his knees and shook me by the hand. You are a brave man, sir, said he. Have a present to make to you, he added, handing me a very tiny glass tube. Tea has been specially prepared by Dr. Fardet. At the supreme moment you have but to put it to your lips and you will be dead in an instant. This was a cheerful beginning. I will confess to you, my friends, that a cold chill passed up my back, and my hair rose upon my head. Excuse me, sir, said I, as I saluted, I am aware that I have volunteered for a service of great danger, but the exact details have not yet been given to me. Colonel Perrin, said Lannes, severely, it is unfair to allow this brave officer to volunteer before he has learned what the perils are to which he will be exposed. But already I was myself once more. Sir, said I, permit me to remark that the greater the danger the greater the glory, and that I could only repent of volunteering if I found that there were no risks to be run. It was a noble speech, and my appearance gave force to my words. For the moment I was a heroic figure. As I saw Lannes' eyes fixed in admiration upon my face, it thrilled me to think how splendid was the debut which I was making in the army of Spain. If I died that night my name would not be forgotten. My new comrades and my old, divided in all else, would still have a point of union in their love and admiration of A.T.N. Gerard. General Razout, explain the situation, said Lannes, briefly. The engineer officer rose, his compasses in his hand. He led me to the door, and pointed to the high gray wall which towered up amongst the debris of the shattered houses. That is the enemy's present line of defense, said he. T is the wall of the great convent of the Madonna. If we can carry it, the city must fall, but they have run countermines all around it, and the walls are so enormously thick that it would be an immense labor to breach it with artillery. We happen to know, however, that the enemy have a considerable store of powder in one of the lower chambers. If that could be exploded, the way would be clear for us. How can it be reached? I asked. I will explain. We have a French agent within the town named Hubert. This brave man has been in constant communication with us, and he had promised to explode the magazine. It was to be done in the early morning, and for 2 days running we have had a storming party of 1,000 grenadiers waiting for the breach to be formed. But there has been no explosion, and for these 2 days we have had no communication from Hubert. The question is, what has become of him? You wish me to go and see? Precisely. Is he ill, or wounded, or dead? Shall we still wait for him, or shall we attempt the attack elsewhere? We cannot determine this until we have heard from him. This is a map of the town, Captain Gerard. You perceive that within this ring of convents and monasteries are a number of streets which branch off from a central square. If you come so far as this square, you will find the cathedral at one corner. In that corner is the street of Toledo. Hubert lives in a small house between a cobbler's and a wine shop, on the right-hand side as you go from the cathedral. Do you follow me? Clearly. You are to reach that house, to see him, and to find out if his plan is still feasible, or if we must abandon it. He produced what appeared to be a roll of dirty brown flannel. This is the dress of a Franciscan friar, said he. Who will find it the most useful disguise? I shrank away from it. It turns me into a spy, I cried. Surely I can go in my uniform? Impossible. How could you hope to pass through the streets of the city? Remember, also, that the Spaniards take no prisoners, and that your fate will be the same in whatever dress you are taken. It was true, and I had been long enough in Spain to know that that fate was likely to be something more serious than mere death. All the way from the frontier I had heard grim tales of torture and mutilation. I enveloped myself in the Franciscan gown. Now I am ready. Are you armed? My saber. They will hear it clang. Take this knife, and leave your sword. Tell Hubert that at 4 o'clock, before dawn, the storming party will again be ready. There is a sergeant outside who will show you how to get into the city. Good night, and good luck. Before I had left the room, the two generals had their cocked hats touching each other over the map. At the door, an under-officer of engineers was waiting for me. I tied the girdle of my gown, and taking off my busby, I drew the cowl over my head. My spurs I removed. Then in silence I followed my guide. It was necessary to move with caution, for the walls above were lined by the Spanish sentries, who fired down continually at our advance posts. Slinking along under the very shadow of the great convent, we picked our way slowly and carefully among the piles of ruins until we came to a large chestnut tree. Here the sergeant stopped. It is an easy tree to climb, said he. Scaling ladder would not be simpler. Go up it, and you will find that the top branch will enable you to step upon the roof of that house. After that it is your guardian angel who must be your guide, for I can help you no more. Girding up the heavy brown gown, I ascended the tree as directed. A half moon was shining brightly, and the line of roof stood out dark and hard against the purple, starry sky. The tree was in the shadow of the house. Slowly I crept from branch to branch until I was near the top. I had but to climb along a stout limb in order to reach the wall. But suddenly my ears caught the patter of feet, and I cowered against the trunk, and tried to blend myself with its shadow. A man was coming toward me on the roof. I saw his dark figure creeping along, his body crouching, his head advanced, the barrel of his gun protruding. His whole bearing was full of caution and suspicion. Once or twice he paused, and then came on again until he had reached the edge of the parapet within a few yards of me. Then he knelt down, leveled his musket, and fired. I was so astonished at this sudden crash at my very elbow that I nearly fell out of the tree. For an instant I could not be sure that he had not hit me. But when I heard a deep groan from below, and the Spaniard leaned over the parapet and laughed aloud, I understood what had occurred. It was my poor, faithful sergeant, who had waited to see the last of me. The Spaniard had seen him standing under the tree, and had shot him. You will think that it was good shooting in the dark, but these people used trabucos, or blunderbusses, which were filled up with all sorts of stones and scraps of metal, so that they would hit you as certainly as I have hit a pheasant on a branch. The Spaniard stood peering down through the darkness, while an occasional groan from below showed that the sergeant was still living. The sentry looked round, and everything was still and safe. Perhaps he thought that he would like to finish off this accursed Frenchman, or perhaps he had a desire to see what was in his pockets. But whatever his motive, he laid down his gun, leaned forward, and swung himself into the tree. The same instant I buried my knife in his body, and he fell with a loud crashing through the branches, and came with a thud to the ground. I heard a short struggle below, and an oath or two in French. The wounded sergeant had not waited long for his vengeance. For some minutes I did not dare to move, for it seemed certain that someone would be attracted by the noise. However, all was silent save for the chimes striking midnight in the city. I crept along the branch, and lifted myself onto the roof. The Spaniard's gun was lying there, but it was of no service to me, since he had the powder horn at his belt. At the same time, if it were found, it would warn the enemy that something had happened, so I thought it best to drop it over the wall. Then I looked round for the means of getting off the roof, and down into the city. It was very evident that the simplest way by which I could get down was that by which the sentinel had got up, and what this was soon became evident. A voice along the roof called Manulo, Manulo, several times, and crouching in the shadow, I saw in the moonlight a bearded head, which protruded from a trapdoor. Receiving no answer to his summons, the man climbed through, followed by three other fellows, all armed to the teeth. You will see here how important it is not to neglect small precautions, for had I left the man's gun where I found it, a search must have followed, and I should certainly have been discovered. As it was, the patrol saw no sign of their sentry, and thought, no doubt, that he had moved along the line of the roofs. They hurried on, therefore, in that direction, and I, the instant that their backs were turned, rushed to the open trapdoor, and descended the flight of steps which led from it. The house appeared to be an empty one, for I passed through the heart of it and out, by an open door, into the street beyond. It was a narrow and deserted lane, but it opened into a broader road, which was dotted with fires, round which a great number of soldiers and peasants were sleeping. The smell within the city was so horrible that one wondered how people could live in it, for during the months that the siege had lasted there had been no attempt to cleanse the streets, or to bury the dead. Many people were moving up and down from fire to fire, and among them, I observed several monks. Seeing that they came and went unquestioned, I took heart and hurried on my way in the direction of the great square. Once a man rose from beside one of the fires, and stopped me by seizing my sleeve. He pointed to a woman who lay motionless on the road, and I took him to mean that she was dying, and that he desired me to administer the last offices of the church. I sought refuge, however, in the very little Latin that was left to me. Ra pro nobis, said I, from the depths of my cowl. E dum laudamus. Ora pro nobis. I raised my hand as I spoke and pointed forward. The fellow released my sleeve, and shrank back in silence, while I, with a solemn gesture, hurried upon my way. As I had imagined, this broad boulevard led out into the central square, which was full of troops and blazing with fires. I walked swiftly onward, disregarding one or two people who addressed remarks to me. I passed the cathedral, and followed the street which had been described to me. Being upon the side of the city which was farthest from our attack, there were no troops encamped in it, and it lay in darkness, save for an occasional glimmer in a window. It was not difficult to find the house to which I had been directed, between the wine shop and the cobbler's. There was no light within and the door was shut. Cautiously I pressed the latch, and I felt that it had yielded. Who was within I could not tell, and yet I must take the risk. I pushed the door open and entered. It was pitch dark within, the more so as I had closed the door behind me. I felt round, and came upon the edge of a table. Then I stood still, and wondered what I should do next, and how I could gain some news of this Hubert, in whose house I found myself. Any mistake would cost me, not only my life, but the failure of my mission. Perhaps he did not live alone. Perhaps he was only a lodger in a Spanish family, and my visit might bring ruin to him as well as to myself. Seldom in my life have I been more perplexed. And then, suddenly, something turned my blood cold in my veins. It was a voice, a whispering voice, in my very ear. Mon Dieu! Cried the voice, in a tone of agony. H. Mon Dieu! Mon Dieu! Then there was a dry sob in the darkness, and all was still once more. It thrilled me with horror, that terrible voice, but it thrilled me also with hope, for it was the voice of a Frenchman. Who is there? I asked. There was a groaning, but no reply. Is that you, Monsieur Hubert? Yes, yes, sighed the voice, so low that I could hardly hear it. Water, water, for heaven's sake, water. I advanced in the direction of the sound, but only to come in contact with the wall. Again I heard a groan, but this time there could be no doubt that it was above my head. I put up my hands, but they felt only empty air. Where are you? I cried. Here. Here. Whispered the strange, tremulous voice. I stretched my hand along the wall, and I came upon a man's naked foot. It was as high as my face, and yet, so far as I could feel, it had nothing to support it. I staggered back in amazement. Then I took a tinder box from my pocket, and struck a light. At the first flash a man seemed to be floating in the air in front of me, and I dropped the box in my amazement. Again with tremulous fingers I struck the flint against the steel, and this time I lit, not only the tinder, but the wax taper. I held it up, and if my amazement was lessened my horror was increased by that which it revealed. The man had been nailed to the wall as a weasel is nailed to the door of a barn. Huge spikes had been driven through his hands and his feet. The poor wretch was in his last agony, his head sunk upon his shoulder, and his blackened tongue protruding from his lips. He was dying as much from thirst, as from his wounds, and these inhuman wretches had placed a beaker of wine upon the table in front of him to add a fresh pang to his tortures. I raised it to his lips. He had still strength enough to swallow, and the light came back a little to his dim eyes. Are you a Frenchman? He whispered. Yes. They have sent me to learn what had befallen you. They discovered me. They have killed me for it. But before I die, let me tell you what I know. A little more of that wine, please. Quick. Quick. I am very near the end. My strength is going. Listen to me. The powder is stored in the Mother Superior's room. The wall is pierced, and the end of the train is in Sister Angela's cell, next the chapel. All was ready 2 days ago. But they discovered a letter, and they tortured me. Good heavens! Have you been hanging here for 2 days? It seems like 2 years. Comrade, I have served France, have I not? Then do one little service for me. Stab me to the heart, dear friend. I implore you, I entreat you, to put an end to my sufferings. The man was indeed in a hopeless plight, and the kindest action would have been that for which he begged. And yet I could not in cold blood drive my knife into his body, although I knew how I should have prayed for such a mercy had I been in his place. But a sudden thought crossed my mind. In my pocket I held that which would give an instant and a painless death. It was my own safeguard against torture, and yet this poor soul was in very pressing need of it, and he had deserved well of France. I took out my phial, and emptied it into the cup of wine. I was in the act of handing it to him, when I heard a sudden clash of arms outside the door. In an instant I put out my light, and slipped behind the window curtains. Next moment the door was flung open, and two Spaniards strode into the room, fierce swarthy men in the dress of citizens, but with muskets slung over their shoulders. I looked through the chink in the curtains in an agony of fear lest they had come upon my traces, but it was evident that their visit was simply in order to feast their eyes upon my unfortunate compatriot. One of them held the lantern which he carried up in front of the dying man, and both of them burst into a shout of mocking laughter. Then the eyes of the man with the lantern fell upon the flagon of wine upon the table. He picked it up, held it, with a devilish grin, to the lips of Hubert, and then, as the poor wretch involuntarily inclined his head forward to reach it, he snatched it back, and took a long gulp himself. At the same instant he uttered a loud cry, clutched wildly at his own throat, and fell stone dead upon the floor. His comrade stared at him in horror and amazement. Then, overcome by his own superstitious fears, he gave a yell of terror, and rushed madly from the room. I heard his feet clattering wildly on the cobblestones until the sound died away in the distance. The lantern had been left burning upon the table, and by its light I saw, as I came out from behind my curtain, that the unfortunate Hubert's head had fallen forward upon his chest, and that he also was dead. That motion to reach the wine with his lips had been his last. A clock ticked loudly in the house, but otherwise all was absolutely still. On the wall, hung the twisted form of the Frenchman, on the floor, lay the motionless body of the Spaniard, all dimly lit by the horn lantern. For the first time in my life a frantic spasm of terror came over me. I had seen 10,000 men in every conceivable degree of mutilation stretched upon the ground, but the sight had never affected me like those two silent figures who were my companions in that shadowy room. I rushed into the street as the Spaniard had done, eager only to leave that house of gloom behind me, and I had run as far as the cathedral before my wits came back to me. There I stopped, panting, in the shadow, and, my hand pressed to my side, I tried to collect my scattered senses, and to plan out what I should do. As I stood there, breathless, the great brass bells roared twice above my head. It was 2 o'clock. 4 was the hour when the storming party would be in its place. I had still 2 hours in which to act. The cathedral was brilliantly lit within, and a number of people were passing in and out, so I entered, thinking that I was less likely to be accosted there, and that I might have quiet to form my plans. It was certainly a singular sight, for the place had been turned into an hospital, a refuge, and a storehouse. One aisle was crammed with provisions, another was littered with sick and wounded, while in the center a great number of helpless people had taken up their abode, and had even lit their cooking fires upon the mosaic floors. There were many at prayer, so I knelt in the shadow of a pillar, and I prayed with all my heart that I might have the good luck to get out of this scrape alive, and that I might do such a deed that night as would make my name as famous in Spain as it had already become in Germany. I waited until the clock struck 3, and then I left the cathedral, and made my way toward the convent of the Madonna, where the assault was to be delivered. You will understand, you who know me so well, that I was not the man to return tamely to the French camp with the report that our agent was dead, and that other means must be found of entering the city. Either I should find some means to finish his uncompleted task, or there would be a vacancy for a senior captain in the Hussars of Conflans. I passed unquestioned down the broad boulevard, which I have already described, until I came to the great stone convent which formed the outwork of the defense. It was built in a square with a garden in the center. In this garden some hundreds of men were assembled, all armed and ready, for it was known, of course, within the town, that this was the point against which the French attack was likely to be made. Up to this time our fighting all over Europe had always been done between one army and another. It was only here in Spain that we learned how terrible a thing it is to fight against a people. On the one hand there is no glory, for what glory could be gained by defeating this rabble of elderly shopkeepers, ignorant peasants, fanatical priests, excited women, and all the other creatures who made up the garrison? On the other hand there were extreme discomfort and danger, for these people would give you no rest, would observe no rules of war, and were desperately earnest in their desire by hook or by crook to do you an injury. I began to realize how odious was our task as I looked upon the motley, but ferocious groups who were gathered round to watch fires in the garden of the convent of the Madonna. It was not for us soldiers to think about politics, but from the beginning there always seemed to be a curse upon this war in Spain. However, at the moment I had no time to brood over such matters as these. There was, as I have said, no difficulty in getting as far as the convent garden, but to pass inside the convent unquestioned was not so easy. The first thing which I did was to walk round the garden, and I was soon able to pick out one large stained glass window which must belong to the chapel. I had understood from Hubert that the Mother Superior's room, in which the powder was stored, was near to this, and that the train had been laid through a hole in the wall from some neighboring cell. I must, at all costs, get into the convent. There was a guard at the door, and how could I get in without explanations? But a sudden inspiration showed me how the thing might be done. In the garden was a well, and beside the well were a number of empty buckets. I filled two of these, and approached the door. The errand of a man who carries a bucket of water in each hand does not need to be explained. The guard opened to let me through. I found myself in a long, stone-flagged corridor, lit with lanterns, with the cells of the nuns leading out from one side of it. Now at last I was on the high road to success. I walked on without hesitation, for I knew by my observations in the garden which way to go for the chapel. A number of Spanish soldiers were lounging and smoking in the corridor, several of whom addressed me as I passed. I fancy it was for my blessing that they asked, and my ora pro nobis seemed to entirely satisfy them. Soon I had got as far as the chapel, and it was easy enough to see that the cell next door was used as a magazine, for the floor was all black with powder in front of it. The door was shut, and two fierce-looking fellows stood on guard outside it, one of them with a key stuck in his belt. Had we been alone, it would not have been long before it would have been in my hand, but with his comrade there it was impossible for me to hope to take it by force. The cell next door to the magazine on the far side from the chapel must be the one which belonged to Sister Angela. It was half open. I took my courage in both hands, and, leaving my buckets in the corridor, I walked unchallenged into the room. I was prepared to find half a dozen fierce Spanish desperados within, but what actually met my eyes was even more embarrassing. The room had apparently been set aside for the use of some of the nuns, who for some reason had refused to quit their home. Three of them were within, one an elderly, stern-faced dame, who was evidently the Mother Superior, the others, young ladies of charming appearance. They were seated together at the far side of the room, but they all rose at my entrance, and I saw with some amazement, by their manner and expressions, that my coming was both welcome and expected. In a moment my presence of mind had returned, and I saw exactly how the matter lay. Naturally, since an attack was about to be made upon the convent, these sisters had been expecting to be directed to some place of safety. Probably they were under vow not to quit the walls, and they had been told to remain in this cell until they received further orders. In any case, I adapted my conduct to this supposition, since it was clear that I must get them out of the room, and this would give me a ready excuse to do so. I first cast a glance at the door and observed that the key was within. I then made a gesture to the nuns to follow me. The Mother Superior asked me some question, but I shook my head impatiently and beckoned to her again. She hesitated, but I stamped my foot and called them forth in so imperious a manner that they came at once. They would be safer in the chapel, and thither I led them, placing them at the end which was farthest from the magazine. As the three nuns took their places before the altar, my heart bounded with joy and pride within me, for I felt that the last obstacle had been lifted from my path. And yet how often have I not found that that is the very moment of danger? I took a last glance at the Mother Superior, and to my dismay I saw that her piercing dark eyes were fixed, with an expression in which surprise was deepening into suspicion, upon my right hand. There were two points which might well have attracted her attention. One was that it was red with the blood of the sentinel whom I had stabbed in the tree. That alone might count for little, as the knife was as familiar as the breviary to the monks of Saragossa. But on my forefinger I wore a heavy gold ring, the gift of a certain German baroness whose name I may not mention. It shone brightly in the light of the altar lamp. Now, a ring upon the friar's hand is an impossibility, since they are vowed to absolute poverty. I turned quickly, and made for the door of the chapel, but the mischief was done. As I glanced back I saw that the Mother Superior was already hurrying after me. I ran through the chapel door, and along the corridor, but she called out some shrill warning to the two guards in front. Fortunately I had the presence of mind to call out also, and to point down the passage, as if we were both pursuing the same object. Next instant I had dashed past them, sprang into the cell, slammed the heavy door, and fastened it upon the inside. With a bolt above and below, and a huge lock in the center, it was a piece of timber that would take some forcing. Even now if they had had the wit to put a barrel of powder against the door I should have been ruined. It was their only chance, for I had come to the final stage of my adventure. Here at last, after such a string of dangers as few men have ever lived to talk of, I was at one end of the powder train, with the Saragossa magazine at the other. They were howling like wolves out in the passage, and muskets were crashing against the door. I paid no heed to their clamor, but I looked eagerly around for that train of which Hubert had spoken. Of course, it must be at the side of the room next to the magazine. I crawled along it on my hands and knees, looking into every crevice, but no sign could I see. Two bullets flew through the door, and flattened themselves against the wall. The thudding and smashing grew ever louder. I saw a gray pile in a corner, flew to it with a cry of joy, and found that it was only dust. Then I got back to the side of the door, where no bullets could ever reach me. They were streaming freely into the room, and I tried to forget this fiendish howling in my ear, and to think out where this train could be. It must have been carefully laid by Hubert lest these nuns should see it. I tried to imagine how I should myself have arranged it had I been in his place. My eye was attracted by a statue of Saint Joseph which stood in the corner. There was a wreath of leaves along the edge of the pedestal, with a lamp burning amidst them. I rushed across to it, and tore the leaves aside. Yes, yes, there was a thin black line, which disappeared through a small hole in the wall. I tilted over the lamp, and threw myself on the ground. Next instant came a roar like thunder, the walls wavered and tottered around me, the ceiling clattered down from above, and over the yell of the terrified Spaniards, was heard the terrific shout of the storming column of grenadiers. As in a dream, a happy dream, I heard it, and then I heard no more. When I came to my senses two French soldiers were propping me up, and my head was singing like a kettle. I staggered to my feet and looked around me. The plaster had fallen, the furniture was scattered, and there were rents in the bricks, but no signs of a breach. In fact, the walls of the convent had been so solid that the explosion of the magazine had been insufficient to throw them down. On the other hand, it had caused such a panic among the defenders that our stormers had been able to carry the windows and throw open the doors almost without assistance. As I ran out into the corridor I found it full of troops, and I met Marshal Lannes himself, who was entering with his staff. He stopped and listened eagerly to my story. "Splendid, Captain Gerard, splendid," he cried. "These facts will certainly be reported to the Emperor. I would suggest to your Excellency," said I, "that I have only finished the work that was planned and carried out by Monsieur Hubert, who gave his life for the cause." "His services will not be forgotten," said the Marshal. "Meanwhile, Captain Gerard, it is 4:30, and you must be starving after such a night of exertion. My staff and I will breakfast inside the city. I assure you that you will be an honored guest." "I will follow your Excellency," said I. "Here is a small engagement which detains me." He opened his eyes. "At this hour?" "Yes, sir," I answered. "Why, fellow officers, whom I never saw until last night, will not be content unless they catch another glimpse of me the first thing this morning." "Au revoir, then," said Marshal Lannes, as he passed upon his way. I hurried through the shattered door of the convent. When I reached the roofless house in which we had held the consultation the night before, I threw off my gown and I put on the busby and saber which I had left there. Then, a hussar once more, I hurried onward to the grove which was our rendezvous. My brain was still reeling from the concussion of the powder, and I was exhausted by the many emotions which had shaken me during that terrible night. It is like a dream, all that walk in the first dim gray light of dawn, with the smoldering campfires around me, and the buzz of the waking army. Bugles and drums in every direction were mustering the infantry, for the explosion and the shouting had told their own tale. I strode onward until, as I entered the little clump of cork oaks behind the horse lines, I saw my 12 comrades waiting in a group, their sabers at their sides. They looked at me curiously as I approached. Perhaps with my powder-blackened face, and my blood-stained hands I seemed a different Gerard to the young captain whom they had made game of the night before. "Good morning, gentlemen," said I. "Regret exceedingly if I have kept you waiting, but I have not been master of my own time." They said nothing, but they still scanned me with curious eyes. I can see them now, standing in a line before me, tall men and short men, stout men and thin men. Olivier, with his warlike mustache, the thin, eager face of Peloton. Young Auden, flushed by his first duel. Mortier, with the sword cut across his wrinkled brow. I laid aside my busby, and drew my sword. "I have one favor to ask you, gentlemen," said I. "Marshal Lannes has invited me to breakfast, and I cannot keep him waiting." "What do you suggest?" asked Major Olivier. "That you release me from my promise, to give you 5 minutes each, and that you will permit me to attack you all together." I stood upon my guard as I spoke. But their answer was truly beautiful and truly French. With one impulse the 12 swords flew from their scabbards, and were raised in salute. There they stood, the 12 of them, motionless, their heels together, each with his sword upright before his face. I staggered back from them. I looked from one to the other. For an instant I could not believe my own eyes. They were paying me homage, these, the men who had jeered me. Then I understood it all. I saw the effect that I had made upon them, and their desire to make reparation. When a man is weak he can steel himself against danger, but not against emotion. "Comrades," I cried, "comrades," but I could say no more. Something seemed to take me by the throat and choke me. And then in an instant Olivier's arms were round me, Peloton had seized me by the right hand, Mortier by the left, some were patting me on the shoulder, some were clapping me on the back, on every side smiling faces were looking into mine, and so it was that I knew that I had won my footing in the Hussars of Conflans. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.